Good morning, everyone. Unfortunately, Hezzy's not able to join us this morning. Maybe in a little while he will. Unfortunately, he has some medical issues that need to be taken care of. And so it's just Brendan and I this morning on the Constitution Today. Let me preface the show by saying that both Brendan and I are tenured faculty members at the WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. And things that we say and the comments that we make and the opinions we give are our own. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or other members of the faculty at large. So we can commence at that point and start talking. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning, and I think I just heard Hezzy. Hezzy, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, there
yes.
You are. Okay. Good morning, Hezzy. We were wondering if you were going to join us this morning or
me.
Not. No, we could hear
well,
other voices in the background,
well
but not
me.
You. Well, that's
okay.
Okay.
Well,
it's
I'm
just
good.
Okay, you're doing good this morning?
I am much better than yesterday, so I'm thrilled.
I'm glad to hear. Well, welcome to your own show. So nice to have you here today.
Well, thank you very much. I'll be quiet. I want to hear what you guys have to say.
No, you don't have to be quiet. We just didn't know you were there or not. That's all. We just making sure you were okay. We lost you once before. We didn't want to lose you again. That's all.
Well, the truth is I didn't even know I could be heard.
Yeah, well, Hezzy, you've been being heard your whole life. I don't think that this is going to make any difference. Okay, how's that sound? Well, I'm glad you're feeling better. I guess we'll start out today with, unless there's something you'd like to talk about, Hezzy, what would you like to talk about this morning? You're the guest.
Well, I've got nothing to say. I'd rather listen to the brainchild that are at the other end.
So would I. So since we all listen to the brainchild, what do you got to say for yourself this morning, Brendan?
Oh, please, you start. I know you've got something on your mind.
Yeah, I always have something on my mind, and what do I really think? And so let me start out with this. As we all are aware, at least anyone who's listened to the news at all, that as a result of the actions taken by the Georgia legislature, and I'm not going to go into the merits of it, but as a result of the actions of the Georgia legislature and Governor Kemp, there have been a number of corporate actions, and we'll get to that in a different way in a few minutes. But I want to talk specifically about the cancellation of the Major League Baseball All-Star Game that was scheduled to take place this year in the new ball field in Atlanta. The first thing I want to mention in kind of in a reversal of roles, Stacey Abrams and the two Democratic senators from Georgia who were recently elected oppose the actions that I'm going to describe that Major League Baseball has taken because they believe that it makes ordinary Georgians, those people who would make a lot of money off of the game, some $100 million would be spent as a result of the game, they would lose that money and they would pay the price.
Good morning.
Other means by which it should be handled, in particular, corporations who are now coming to the forefront. Major League Baseball decided to cancel the All-Star Game in Atlanta. They have now announced that they are moving it to Colorado, kind of a message since Colorado has one of the most liberal voting laws in the country and they have almost complete mail-in voting there. And that's the way that they've operated for a long time. They send out ballots to every registered voter and that's how they get them to vote. So they thought that that was a message. So it's going to Denver this July. I want to talk about what happened as a result of that action, in particular about two of my favorite members of the United States Senate, First, Senator Marco Rubio, my senator, so I have the right to say whatever I want about him. It's someone I've known for, at least known of and known for a long time, calling out the commissioner of Major League Baseball as being hypocritical in his decision, and wanted to know that if he was canceling the All-Star game in Atlanta, would the commissioner resign his membership in the Augusta National Golf Club, which happens to be in Georgia, and most of us know that it is the home of the Masters Tournament. What one has to know is once you are a member, this wasn't brought out, but once you're a member of Augusta National, you never pay for anything again as long as you belong there. The Masters Tournament makes so much money Augusta makes so much money off of the Masters that literally people who belong to the club never have to pay for anything ever once you are a member. So the question is, how much does Augusta actually add to the economy of Georgia? Is based solely upon how much money it brings in and obviously the taxes it pays from the billions of dollars that they have made off of CBS Sports, who has a long-standing exclusive to cover the Masters. So I'm not sure how hypocritical it is for him to not give up his green jacket. But Marco Rubio is one of the true hypocrites in American politics. He says one thing, he does another. He says whatever seems to flow in the direction of popularity and or what satisfies his base. His word is not to be trusted. Marco Rubio swore when he ran for president, he resigned as a senator, said he wasn't going to run for reelection, but got a friend of his to chair sit for him and hold the seat so that if he didn't get the presidential nomination, he could then file to be reelected and thus lose no seniority and never have to resign because he had been reelected or elected to a new term. He was clearly hypocritical about this, and many of the things that he talks about, far too numerous to mention, are hypocritical in themselves. So I guess it takes one to know one. But I see a difference between, and Marco tried to show this as being the same thing as some of the corporations. But my answer to him, as far as the commissioner is concerned, is the commissioner is the CEO of a corporation. What he does with his personal time, he is subject to be criticized for. But he has a board of directors. It's called the owners of every single one of those baseball teams. He has stockholders, which are not only the owners, but the players. And he has to satisfy them. I'm not sure that anybody can say he made this decision on his own, because he did not. And so therefore, it's hypocritical for Marco to call him out. And I leave it at that. The second person I want to pick on is dear Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who came out this week after CEOs of numerous corporations, least of which, were Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola. Major employers in Georgia, major producers of income for the state of Georgia, who criticized this bill, this voting bill, and we can talk about it later as to how the people are being misled about what this bill does. It was purposely designed to look like they were doing the right thing when they did the right thing and then took it all back on the other side with the wrong thing. But Mitch McConnell had the nerve, of all the people, to criticize the CEOs of all these numerous corporations, telling them that they're CEOs of corporations and they should worry about their bottom line and they should stay out of politics. Yeah. I'm sorry. He isn't. He doesn't want them to stay out of politics when he wants their money. Isn't that getting involved in politics? He doesn't care. Give me the money and shut up and do what you're told. That's what he's saying to these CEOs. I don't know who he thinks he's talking to, but he isn't doing a whole lot for his fundraising. And he sits there and he argued in the past that money is free speech and corporations are people and they should be able to contribute any way they want to and as much as they want to and not have to answer to anybody but their stockholders. Okay, they don't answer to you, Mitch McConnell. And if they decide to speak up and tell you you're wrong, I think it behooves you and your senatorial campaign committee to listen to them because they're holding the purse strings, not you. You just don't like being told what to do. If I'm the CEO of Coca-Cola, I'm going to say to him, okay, Mitch, we'll stay out of politics. We want our money back that we contributed to you and every other Republican senator. And we're not giving you another dime. And that goes for the people in the House, too. How do you like them apples? Wrong thing to say, Mitch. Wrong thing. And as hypocritical as it comes. But that should be no surprise for Mitch McConnell either. And that's how what I think about that.
Okay.
The chutzpah. The chutzpah. Right, Hezzy?
Absolutely. That's called Gaul, G-A-L-L.
For those who are listening who are not of the Jewish faith, chutzpah is unmitigated gall. As defined in the Hebrew, in the American Hebrew Dictionary, it's that ability of a person to murder his mother and father and then stand in front of the judge and ask for mercy because he's an orphan.
That sounds so typically Jewish. I can't stand it.
Yes, very.
I want in
okay,
on this conversation.
Turn,
I know, I know chutzpah. I also know verklempt, right? Isn't that a good one too?
Verklempt, yes,
verklempt. Yeah. Yes, right. Which I usually am. That's why I know the word.
That's how Colonel Klemp got his name from Hogan's Heroes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Really? I have no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was Jewish, by the way. The guy
yeah.
was really Jewish.
Right.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a...
As was John Banner. Sergeant
oh, really?
Johnson.
Wow.
Nothing. Yeah, they were both Jewish.
I loved him. he was great. So.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Brendan, now that we've had our laugh, your turn.
All right. Well, yeah. Mine is going to be mostly anecdotal, but revolve around some big issues. One of the things, you know, in terms of this, what I really think, I've been thinking this for a long time, but I thought this would be a good time to talk about it, given current events. The next time I hear somebody say elections don't matter, or it doesn't matter who you vote for, my life never changes, right? Based on who's in office, I think I'm just going to lose my mind. It's being illustrated that elections do matter, and they do make a difference in people's lives in a very, very real way. I myself have been going a little nuts whenever I hear people say that, and I'm sure you both have heard people say that all the time, right? Why would I go out and vote? What do I care who wins? And nothing ever changes. It's always, they're all the same, all this nonsense. But I started taking it more personally in 2009 to 2011, when, like many Americans, I lost almost all the value I had in my home because of the financial crisis. A financial crisis, a collapse, right? The collapse of 2008 and 2009 that was brought on. You can draw a straight line from the deregulation of financial institutions to that collapse. You can draw a straight line from what George W. Bush called his quote-unquote home ownership society, which was really a deregulation program that let the banks run loose with predatory lending in the housing market. Right, that created a quote unquote bubble that eventually burst. And you know, you can, you know, we can parse out blame to both parties to some extent, but that was largely a George W. Bush project. The result for me was the loss of a home at 50% of the value of my home. I was underwater. Mm. So when I went to move from Michigan to Florida, I had to deal with that. So, you know, right then I started saying to myself, okay, nobody can tell me elections don't matter. You know, this kind of thing is impacting not just me, but millions and millions of Americans who are in the same boat. Now we're seeing on the flip side of it, right? So that was negative impact. Now, like many Americans, I am weeks away from being fully vaccinated against the coronavirus. Right? I've already had my first shot, scheduled for my second shot in 10 days. And this simply would not have happened. We'd be waiting until the end of summer if Donald Trump were still president. There would be no streamlined plan, no centralized plan for distribution, a massive increase in manufacturing, and a directive to states to get their act together. Jeff and I live in Florida, where now my understanding is practically any adult can make an appointment for a vaccine. We've reached a point where there are days now where 4 million people, right, almost 1% of the U.S. population is being vaccinated in a single day. You cannot achieve that level of competence, efficiency, without believing that there's even a problem, right? If Donald Trump had won re-election, we'd still have a president who got vaccinated secretly in January. Without telling anybody that he'd been vaccinated, because otherwise he'd have to admit this is not a hoax, which his believers carry on, right, in that mindset even after he himself was infected with COVID. So that's what I think. I think that people need to stop saying elections don't matter. If you've got a $1,400 check in your bank account that wasn't there before, if you're getting your COVID vaccine months ahead of when you thought you were going to get your vaccine, if by the end of this month or sometime next month you're able to participate in society again, without having to go through yet another year of this, then stop saying elections don't matter and start voting. That's what I think.
Yeah, I've always followed that up with the thought process that you have no right to complain about how your government does or does not work if you don't vote. You forfeited your right to complain. I have believed that for a long time. You can think what you want, but don't complain unless you tried to do something about it when you had the opportunity. That's the way that I look at it. So, you know, keep your complaints to yourself. Talk about them at the dinner table. And when your kid says, "Dad, who did you vote for?" You can say, "I didn't vote for anybody because nothing ever changes." Really? Okay, well, Dad, aren't things changing for better or for worse? They just don't see it. And I think you're absolutely right, Brendan. You know, stop complaining and saying government doesn't do anything. Government doesn't do anything when the people running the government don't want to do anything. When they want to do something, they can get it done. I'm a firm believer in that. So I agree with you on that 100%. So I'm sure that there's a lot of people out there who will continue to say it was interesting. I can't remember the interview that I saw a piece of a journalist, by the way, who had interviewed, and I wish I could remember his name. I'm going to start looking it up while we're talking. But the guy he interviewed, he was doing a documentary on QAnon. And this is the guy who apparently runs the main posting board of what Q says and what Q means. And it turns out this guy is a former intelligence officer who ran a low-level blog for a long time. He apparently is the man behind QAnon. In other words, he is Q, if there is such a person. And the interviewer, the director of the movie's name was Colin Hoback. And he was on Anderson Cooper. And he identified the person he believed was Q. And he basically admitted it without admitting it. I mean, he danced around it, but he basically admitted it and laughed about it. Somewhere along the line, these people who believe in QAnon, they've got to start realizing that there is a person behind this. And the person who's behind it is not a member of the intelligence community, and he's not someone within the bureaucracy. He's not any of those people. Okay? He's just a guy with a computer, with an intelligence background. That's all he is. And he's laughing about it as he's being interviewed. He's standing outside while he's being interviewed wearing a parka. And he's just laughing about it. He just thinks it's hysterical that people are buying into this stuff. I stop making your decisions based upon some blogger. Start making your decisions over things that you educate yourself on. And that's not an education. And if I'm missing something, tell me.
It sounds like you found Donald Trump's famous 400-pound hacker, right?
Well, he's not 400 pounds, but we found his hacker. Okay, I mean, I don't know. I get confused by people who just buy into this. It's a docuseries that's coming on. I'm not sure exactly when, but I'm going to watch it.
Yeah.
HBO's got it. And I'm going to watch it and see if Hoback has it resolved, whether he's got the guy. The guy's name, I think, is Watkins, if I'm not incorrect. There are various figures that are involved in this. There's a guy named Frederick Brennan, who's a software developer, who created and then repudiated his own creation of 8chain, which is where people go to blog and to relate to each other, and where Q initially appeared, whoever he is. And key 8chain figures Jim and Ron Watkins, a father and pair son, who are deeply tied to all of this. These are just people who are just creating something to feel important.
Right.
And don't care about the damage that they do.
Right.
Okay. I just don't get it.
Yeah.
But maybe someone can really explain it to me.
No, I think you're onto something there. I mean, it's we've talked about this so many times, but I'm fascinated by the psychology of how this kind of thing happens. Right? How some anonymous source shows up on the internet and claims to be a prophet. I suppose, you know, isn't that kind of how they look at Q? Right? There's this like Oz, right? There's this kind of magical figure who purports to be a prophet, and of course, whose every prophecy, turns out to be bunk. Right? But nonetheless,
and then they come up with an excuse for it and give you another prophecy based upon
right.
the excuse.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. The moving goalpost.
I don't get it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Just keep moving the goalpost back so that you never quite get there to kick the field goal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll figure it out someday why these people are so into him. Maybe Q is actually the character and took his name from the character in Star Trek Next Generation. You know, the omnipotent Q, member of the Q continuum, okay, who could do anything he wanted and create anything he wanted. Maybe that's how he got his name.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the name of the documentary, it's a 6-part documentary called Q, Into the Storm. And it'll be interesting to be able to find out exactly where he's led. But he talks to this one person online, and they're laughing at all the Q followers,
mm-hmm.
the two of them together. But this is a guy who posts on the Q who says he's like, I guess he considers himself, for lack of a better way to put it, a prophet. Q is God, and he's a prophet. Most people who are far right wingers, okay, for lack of a better way to put it, at least claim that they are religious. And if they are, how do you put one God in front of the other? That's all
yeah.
I got to say about that.
Don't many people kind of see Donald Trump that way? Donald Trump followers see him as sort of an infallible leader, somebody sent from God, who is not to be questioned. It doesn't matter, you know, what he does, what he proposes, where he stands on any particular issue. He's just reached into something inside people. We've talked about this before too, but some kind of permission structure. And as you mentioned before, sense of belonging and sense of power, where he brought something out in people. That's all about, it's not about any idea. It's just about the leader, which of course is the most dangerous type of paradigm, you know, in human history, right? To generate that kind of a response in a masses of people. But it's magical thinking. It's treating humans, whether they're anonymous like Q, or whether they're out there in the open like Donald Trump, treating them as at least quasi deities. I've been musing for weeks here. You know, I wish we could get to the bottom of the psychology of this. Maybe this series, that documentary series that you're talking about, will seek to do that. Again, this is anecdotal, but it seems like those people who sort of come out of QAnon, it's like when a cult member snaps out of it, right? And you ask, well, what is the point at which somebody snaps out of a trance, right? They're in a trance. If we could get an answer to that, this is why I've joked before that if I had another life to live, I think I'd be a political psychologist, because it seems all to come down to that, right? The dynamics of human thought as it relates to political outcomes, and frankly, kind of like I hear the frustration in your voice, Jeff. I don't understand, and this is what is so problematic in our culture right now. I think is we have these different parts of the country, and I don't mean geographically; I mean politically. These different factions. It's not just that we don't speak the same language, we're not even seeing the same colors. We're not seeing the same forms. We don't perceive reality the same way. We don't filter information the same way. I think one of the more interesting, aspects of psychology that I also think is in play is you know, are we talking to people who are capable of admitting they were wrong about something? You know, in my own life, I've let go of a lot of beliefs. I don't know what it is about me or about people who think like me, or but I'm not wed to certain belief systems. I'm open to saying, you know, if new evidence emerges, or if just somebody points to a fault in my thinking, that I was wrong about something. And I sense that there's a lot of that going on as well. People who once they've got an idea or a belief system in their head, their instinct is never to question it, always to defend it. And the more you attack their beliefs, the more violent, right? I mean, violence, not just literally, but, you know, I mean, emotional type of violent reaction you're going to get.
I happen to agree with you, and I think I've said this several times, that part of the problem with changing minds, and I think that it's a slow process. Some polls came out recently that were rather encouraging. Although the numbers would seem to discourage you, the trend was encouraging. I can talk about that in a minute. But changing people's minds, there's something about human beings that make them incapable of admitting that they're wrong. We always talk about the person who admits that they're wrong or admits their mistakes as being, quote, the bigger person, close quote. And people don't do that anymore. It's not that it started 4 years ago, but it became, for lack of a better way to put it, a mantra for some people. With Donald Trump, who said, I never admit I'm wrong. I never apologize for anything. It's a sign of weakness. So even when I apologize, I don't apologize.
Mm-hmm.
And people have learned to believe that it's a sign of weakness as opposed to what can really be a sign of strength. The ability to be able to say, I was wrong. The ability to say that I've learned something from being wrong. For whatever it may be, when we become adults, we refuse to accept that which we knew when we were younger. And that was, we learn from our mistakes. And that's the learning process of being a child and being a teenager. And we somehow refuse to accept that. Even to this very day, there are people in their hearts who know full well that they were wrong for voting for Donald Trump, but refuse to admit that they were wrong. There may be some people in the future who knows what the future holds, who might say I was, you know, who might refuse to say I was wrong for voting for Joe Biden. I don't know. But I do know that if you don't learn to admit when you've made a mistake, you know, yesterday I went to have a blood test done, and I sat there for an hour, and I saw people go in and go out that had gotten there after I did, and I couldn't understand what was going on. I confronted the person who was there, and I said, you know, I had an appointment at 12:30. It's 1:30. And she says, well, you're a walk-in. I says, no, I'm not a walk-in. I had an appointment at 12:30. And I talked to him, and I started to get really frustrated and disturbed. And then all of a sudden, I looked at my phone with the appointment on and realized the appointment wasn't for yesterday. It was next Monday. Well, okay, I'm 72 years old. I made a mistake. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, I forget. Time flies when you're having fun. You know. Well, when when you're over the hill, you gain momentum. So life is like a roll of toilet paper. The more you use, the faster it goes. But I mean, it's just. But I just you know, so I had to apologize to these people because I was just wrong. You had to be able to walk up to somebody and say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. Okay? You're not Fonzie. You don't sit there and go, I was because you can't get the word wrong out. Okay? Okay, just, you know, buck up. Okay? I was wrong. I'm sorry. You'd be amazed how well those two words will get a smile out of somebody. They just became your best friend for life, okay, because you can admit that you were wrong, even though you made their life miserable 30 seconds ago, okay? That's what's wrong with our politics, is that no one can accept that they were wrong in their choice or wrong in their position. No one wants to back down because it's a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of weakness. And people just, so I think that what you were saying, what I'm saying feeds into what you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. Okay? Just admit that you're wrong. That's all. It's not that hard. It's a little right. embarrassing at first. Okay. Hang your eyes and pretend that they can't see you. Okay. And say it. Okay. And then all of a sudden now they'll say, okay, I appreciate that you apologize. Thank you. Okay. And move on. Okay, so I'll show up next Monday to get my blood drawn. That's all. And that'll be the end of it. Okay, so I'm going to sit there another hour and wait. That was for sure. So,
yeah.
As a walk-in.
Right.
So I just said, okay, I'll see you next Monday, and I left. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, and that's what you have to do when you talk to people. I'm following up on what you said. I agree with you. People have to start accepting their wrongfulness. And that Q stuff with this Ron Haskins, I guess, being Q, that all the evidence points to him because he's been essential. Now, not that there aren't other people involved, but he seems to be the linchpin over all these years. And he was the one that was laughing it up and thought it was funny. Well, it's not funny. You're attempting to destroy the United States government for fun. Do me a favor, okay? Go out into the middle of Atlantic in a rowboat and put a hole in it and sink with it, okay? Do us all a big favor. And eventually we'll find you at the bottom, you know, with your boat, you know, like they're finding all these ships now. You know, we'll send a submarine down to make sure you're really down there, okay? Okay.
Okay. Oh, God.
You know, don't do this stuff, okay? Leave it at that. Okay.
Well, and you know, it's in case anybody's wondering, what does this have to do with the Constitution today, right? Because, you know, we tend to get into these philosophical discussions.
We get into the weeds.
Yeah. It is. It does relate to the Constitution. Another buddy of mine always says, an institution is only as good as the people who inhabit it, and it's only as good as it's only as good as they are, honorable, right, and trustworthy. When you talk about our constitutional institutions, there are many, but because the Constitution creates a republic at both the federal and state level. The number one, you know, the most important part of our political infrastructure, our most important, if you will, political institution, is the voter. The government institutions will be occupied by the people we put there, and when we make that choice of who to put there, the output, right, which is your vote. Is only as good as the inputs, right? The information that informs your vote. If you're getting your information from a propaganda outfit, or from the dark web, or from a website run by QAnon, you know the old saying, "Garbage in, garbage out." If that's the informational input that's informing your citizenship and your vote. Well, then that's how we wind up with some of the people we've wound up with. And that is a constitutional problem, because now you have people who are not honorable, who are not trustworthy, who do not take their oath of office seriously, and who would just as soon overthrow the United States, right, as get up in the morning. And so, again, talking about elections matter, what was on the ballot in our last election was nothing short of the continuing existence of this republic. And we came awfully close to losing it. So I just wanted to make that point. It sounds ethereal and sounds kind of pie in the sky, some of the stuff we talk about, but it is constitution. It is critical to the survival of the constitutional structure that we have.
Good point. One of the other things that we wanted to talk about today was obviously the pink elephant in the room, and that's the Chauvin case.
Yeah.
And it's kind of important to talk about. At this point, I want to start out with one thought process. I had talked last week that I don't want to see people lobbying a verdict in this case from outside of the courtroom. I think that is contrary to the way that we run our system of justice, and I think that it is it subverts the rule of law and the way that we apply our laws. But with all of that said, and that's a different subject, I am concerned in that lobbying idea or that rush to judgment. And I want to preface this with I have my own opinion based upon what I've heard that, Derek Chauvin should not walk out of that courtroom. I honestly believe that, just from what I've heard. But there are issues there that are serious issues. But the problem of what the public is getting, and I am criticizing the liberal press in this particular instance, that they have their pundits, who are all former prosecutors, who are, in many cases, have, for lack of a better way to put it, a dog in the fight, who talk about, and even the regular hosts of these shows, all they talk about is what comes out on direct examination from a witness. And they pay no attention whatsoever to the cross-examination that's taking place.
Mm-hmm.
There's an adage that defense attorneys go by that the truth only comes out on cross-examination. That is, you test somebody's story to determine whether it is factual, whether it is accurate or not, on cross-examination. Prosecutors don't test people's memories. It takes what it can get from them, whether it's accurate or not. And unless they know it's inaccurate, they sit there and say, well, the jury decides what's accurate. And they excuse mm-hmm. some of the witnesses they have by just saying, this is what they told me. I'm putting on their testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they are, they deny vouching for their credibility. But it's cross-examination. And there have been things that have come out on cross-examination which diminish the effect of what has come out on direct examination, but somehow never finds its way into a news report. And it's distressing to see that occur witness after witness after witness. Or where they have been caught in inaccuracies, as a few of them have been, but yet there's just literally no conversation about it. You know, this doctor testified yesterday, and it was the start of what I want to call proving proof of guilt by establishing what it isn't, not what it is. Proving that there was, in fact, how can I put this, the cause of death by what it wasn't, because they can't establish exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it started with the doctor from the emergency room. And it will continue itself through all of these experts they're going to put on. Now, I kind of believe that they're going to mitigate their losses by putting the coroner on, who said that it was heart failure, but didn't ascribe it to anything in particular. He couldn't. And yet now we're going to try to prove how Mr. Floyd died by what wasn't his cause of death or what couldn't have caused his death, as opposed to what actually did. Now, am I sitting there saying that with all of the factors we have, that based upon what we've heard so far, that Chauvin contributed to that death? I think the answer is most likely going to be answered yes. But you can't ignore all the other factors that were going on, like the testimony of his girlfriend who said he was in the hospital 2 months before having overdosed on the same drugs that he was taking on the day of his death, and the additional drugs he stuck in his mouth to avoid being caught with them that were found on the floor of the police cruiser with his DNA on him. We can't ignore those things. And it's as much as they think it's the protesters stand up and say, but that's assassinating his character, it's not. It's not what they want to hear, okay? But you can't ignore the possibility that they contributed to his death. You can't do that. And it's not that Chauvin is going to walk out of the courtroom, because I don't believe he will, but it is the difference between a murder in the second degree or a murder in the third degree or involuntary manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Second-degree murder is defined in Minnesota at what we call a depraved heart theory. What we describe in Florida is he's doing something that evinces a depraved mind regardless of human life. Depraved heart is very simply this. You do something knowingly that could cause the death of another, even though you don't intend to kill anyone. It's a severe form of criminal recklessness.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the guy who throws a brick off of a tall building, knowing full well it could hit somebody and kill them. Or shooting your gun into a moving train, knowing there are people on the train and it kills someone.
Mm-hmm.
Or driving your boat through a crowd of swimmers. Or in the old days of the barnstormers, bringing your plane so low to the ground, passing over people, that you decapitate a tall person with the landing gear. Okay? Those are the kind of things that are depraved heart. And I understand that someone will say putting your knee on the neck of someone or the back of someone and asphyxiating them is doing something, but you have to do it knowing that that's going to cause death or great bodily harm. That's a tall order for this situation. Third degree murder is they have to prove that what Chauvin did, he had a specific intent to cause great bodily harm to George Floyd. Without that, you can't get to third degree murder. I don't think you're going to get there. But involuntary manslaughter is doing an act which can foreseeably cause the death of another. that it's outside the scope of what society would consider to be reasonable. And so therefore, what you have under those circumstances is what we call culpable negligence, criminal negligence. That's where I think the jury's going to end up. Because and still, you've got to be able to prove that something that Chauvin did contributed to the death. And I don't know how you do that. The guy who did the autopsy, the medical examiner is going to say he could not find if the kind of force it was necessary to cut off George Floyd's breathing was happening, you would see bruises either outside or on the inside of the skin. There were no bruises. That's a critical finding. So all I'm trying to say is I want the press to bring out not only what comes out on direct examination, but what's happening on cross, because there are things that are mitigating what's being said on cross. And I think this guy who is doing this trial all by himself against 14 lawyers is doing a phenomenal job with a very bad case, mm-hmm. with a very difficult case. So I just think that people need to pay more attention. The direct is over, and they're convinced that that's the truth, and they don't listen to the cross-examination. You have to listen to the cross-examination. Mm-hmm. There have been holes punched in the prosecution's case.
Right.
Yeah. Right, Hezzy?
Yeah.
It that's, happened again.
Yeah.
Hezzy, I know you're
I'm
there,
here.
Hezzy. Okay,
I'm
okay.
Here,
just
definitely.
Make sure. Okay, just making sure. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, I don't know, you've been watching it. What do you think, Brendan?
Yeah, it's, I'm going to pick your brain about some of the evidence, because I agree with everything you've said. From what I've seen, yeah, the defense attorney is doing what he can with what you'd call a bad case. I do think it's a bad case from the defense standpoint. But,
oh yeah,
you know, you really did a good job explaining depraved heart. And the way I talk about depraved heart murder is pretty much along the lines of what you said, which is somebody who knowingly creates a risk of death, right? So you don't have to know you're going to kill somebody, but you have to at least know that you're creating a substantial risk that somebody could be killed. And to me, depraved heart means you're the kind of person who you're going to go to bed the night you kill somebody and sleep like a baby, right? Well, you know, if you didn't kill somebody, that's fine. And if you did kill somebody, that's fine too. That's a depraved heart. And to that end, I do think that the prosecutor is building a powerful case. And there are two pieces of evidence that I find particularly compelling. One is what I will admit out front as an emotional, but that's part, as Jeff, as you know, as well as anybody, part of winning a jury trial is getting an emotional response, the emotional response you want from a jury. And the picture that the prosecutor keeps showing of then officer Chauvin with his knee on George Floyd's neck, and it's a kind of front, a little bit off to the side view, where he's looking, Chauvin is looking at the camera. You couldn't graphically illustrate better than that photo somebody who just doesn't seem to care. There's a reason they keep showing that photo, is because if they're going to try to show a depraved heart, right, I think that's the kind of image they want. The second thing that I thought the prosecutor really hit home, and there was rebuttal to this, but I thought it was an interesting point, was he got the police chief, of the Minneapolis Police Department, to talk a lot about what the police chief himself calls the sanctity of life. and that it is their policy to care for the lives of the people they protect, and of course, in particular, the lives of the people they have in custody. And how, and he actually was able to testify that the way that Officer Chauvin behaved did not show that respect for the value of life. So you can see the link there that they're trying to make between department policy and between the opinion of the police chief and this idea of depraved heart. If the jury doesn't think that the evidence rises to that level, then yes, then criminal negligence or a lesser degree of recklessness, I suppose, would give rise to a finding of involuntary manslaughter. And I also agree, you know, I only, unlike you, Jeff, I only tried one murder case when I was in practice. And the entire issue in that case was causation. And that's the one of the elements you were hitting on here is, right, the prosecutor has to show that the defendant caused the death of another human being. In my case, we had a medical examiner and an ER doc telling the jury that the injury that caused the death of the person who died was not the injury that was caused by the defendant, that those were two different separate injuries. So we tend to focus in these criminal trials on what the fancy talk that we use, Jeff, on the mens rea, right, on the mental state required for a conviction. And sometimes we lose sight of what lawyers call the actus reus, which is the physical elements, right, of the crime. And so they're both in play here. There's a question of whether the defendant caused the death on the actus reus side, and over on the mental state side, there's the question of, was he merely negligent? Negligence meaning just should have known the risk, right? Or was he reckless, which means he did know the risk? Or was he so reckless that he showed a depraved heart? So there's a lot. There are a lot of moving parts in this trial. There's going to be a lot for the jury to decide.
I will tell you that I think the prosecution has done what it needs to do. It opened with huge guns. It opened with multiple people, including a 9-year-old girl, to testify to what she saw and what others saw. To try to create as much emotion as they possibly could, and that's we have a horse here. hello, Hezzy. I feel bad for him. He just doesn't feel good. I understand. But they opened with as much emotion as they possibly could because it's meant to detract from the real weakness in their case, which is the lack of ability to establish any kind of mens rea in this case. It's very, very difficult. And the second reason, and the second problem is proving cause of death. Trying to establish Chauvin as being the primary cause of death as opposed to being a contributory cause of death. And I think that they're doing the best they can by trying to put their case together in a manner that really kind of hopes that the jury will ignore the lacking part of their case. And when they get up in closing and they say, look, we've proven that cause of death wasn't this, we proved cause of death wasn't that, we proved cause of death wasn't this or that, and they go through about the 5 or 6 things that the state's going to prove didn't contribute to the death, and then say, that only leaves one thing for you to decide, that in fact Chauvin did cause the death. Okay? That's what they're going to try to argue. They're going to try to get the jury to buy into their theory, despite what may be serious holes in their theory. So they're doing what they have to do. I understand they're doing what they have to do. Done it myself, okay? You know, get people emotionally attached, emotionally invested. That's what you want. You want them emotionally invested in the outcome of the case. And to make up their minds so that they ignore everything else. That's what they're trying to do. And I understand that. That is trial strategy. The defense attorney is trying to very methodically poke holes in their case so that when he stands up to close, he can sit there and say, now the prosecution told you this witness said this, but they didn't tell you that they would say this, that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is a serious theory issue in the prosecution when the jury now starts to realize you've been withholding things from me. That really upsets the jury. It makes them question the entirety of the prosecution case. I learned very early as a prosecutor, you got bad piece of evidence, put it on yourself. Minimize its effect. Say, we give you the good and the bad, but that bad isn't as bad as they're trying to make it out to be.
Right.
That, to me, is the best way to try a case. But they're doing what they need to do. They know where the problems in their case are. And so that's what they'll do.
This kind of implicates something we already talked about, which is changing people's minds, right?
Right.
You know, what do you do if you're a defense lawyer? Because here's my suspicion as I watch, you know, what I've been able to watch. Again, I haven't watched the whole thing, but what I have been able to watch definitely has an emotional angle to it. That's unavoidable, obviously, in a case like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking a couple points during the trial. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a juror or two here who's decided this guy's committed murder and I've made my mind up. And then, of course, the question for a defense attorney is the same thing we were talking about earlier. How do you change somebody's mind, right, after it's already made up? This is something, by the way, as long as we're talking about lawyering, that I think a lot of lawyers, especially when they're new, don't understand, especially when they're in front of an appellate court, is that by the time you're arguing a case, right, in front of a panel of judges, those judges have largely already made up their minds.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, I always say oral argument.
I've often wondered why we even do oral arguments.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that true? And you watch lawyers, and sometimes you think, you know, I'm watching this lawyer at oral argument. It seems like they think this is their chance to persuade the court that they're right. They don't seem to understand that what oral argument is your last chance to change the court's mind, right, to change their mind,
right,
that have already been made up.
Right.
And so it's sort of the same dynamic here, right? If that's what you're dealing with a jury, if you've got 12 people who by the time the prosecution rests have pretty much made up their minds, if you're a defense attorney, how do you get into their minds and make them understand that it's okay for them to change their minds? I'm going to ask you that question since you've had more experience with this.
Well, I've always accepted, and in voir dire, I've always raised the issue as a defense attorney, which is some people think is dangerous, but I don't think it is, to stand up in front of a jury during voir dire, and sometimes even in my opening statement saying, obviously, the state is going to put on evidence that would seem to indicate that my client committed this offense.
Right.
Okay? Because we wouldn't be sitting here if they didn't think they had evidence. And if there wasn't something that would seem to point to my client.
Mm-hmm.
But seemingly pointing to my client doesn't prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. And I always argue the point that you may have a gut level kind of thought process that my client is guilty. But your gut level feeling is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, because proof of beyond a reasonable doubt is where you have a firm and abiding conviction that the defendant is guilty, not one that wavers and vacillates and you see the good and the bad. You have to have a firm and abiding conviction. And I think that that's how you change people's minds. You don't actually change their mind. You get them to do their duty.
Right.
instead of going on the basis of my client's innocent, and I try to tell them, not guilty does not mean innocent.
Right.
It just means the state didn't prove their case. If you're not happy about the verdict, let the prosecution know they did a crappy job. But don't find my client guilty because you're trying to do the prosecution's job for them.
Mm-hmm.
Their job's to make it impossible for you to vote any other way. And I think that's how you change their minds. It's easier to, quote, change someone's mind about how they're going to vote if they haven't announced it to anybody yet.
Right.
When they announce themselves, whether it's voting for Trump or not, there's a sense of pride in what you've done. And there's a sense of your own pride, of your own ability to reach a conclusion, which is important. And so, therefore, you stick with it because you don't, quote, want to admit you were wrong, close quote.
Right.
So in a case involving where you're sitting on a jury, you're not supposed to talk about and you don't announce how you're going to vote, at least to your fellow jurors, until you go back in the room and deliberate. So that's how I've always worked it. It doesn't work when the evidence is so strongly against you. Lost my cases in time. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because the evidence was so overwhelming that the problem is, and let me just tell you the truth, when you're the defense attorney, you go in there knowing you're going to lose. And somewhere in the mm-hmm. middle of the trial, you start buying your own BS. Okay? And you start believing your client's going to get off. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get let down when the verdict comes back guilty. That's just a truism. Any defense lawyer will tell you that happens. Okay?
Right.
But the truth of the matter is that, you know, if you lose because the evidence is so strong against your client that he should be convicted, then all you're really trying to do is protect his constitutional rights and any right to an appeal if he gets convicted. That's all
right.
you can do. And in this particular
right.
case, this lawyer is not trying to walk Derek Chauvin out of the courtroom. He knows that's not going to happen. He knows it. Okay, not that he's admitting it, but you can tell
right.
by what he's doing that he's working as hard as he can to diminish the state's case in order to allow the jury to reach a lesser verdict.
Right.
That's all he's trying to do. He's trying to give them permission.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's trying to do. And I think that in my opinion, I think he's going to get there. If the testimony comes out as it's projected, it will come out.
What's the sentencing difference between a depraved part murder?
The difference
and,
is about 15 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
So big difference.
So it's a big difference. I mean, it's a difference between Chauvin coming out either dead or so old that he needs help, okay, or he comes out a fairly young man.
Mm-hmm.
He comes out in his mid-50s. That's the difference.
Right.
And you just need to give the jury a reason, an excuse, and permission to do something lesser than what the government's asking for. That's what you're looking for. And the great part is that I'll give you the perfect example. I tried a case in front of probably the toughest sentencing judge in federal court back in the 80s. And I had the lead defendant, the number one defendant, in a seven-defendant drug conspiracy case.
Mm-hmm.
And during the case, what I did is I let another lawyer do a cross-examination on the confidential informant, the guy that was involved in it, the co-conspirator informant. And I let her do the cross to find out everything she possibly could. She basically took a deposition, a whole day deposition. And then I asked about 3 hours worth of questions. And literally, during all of this, the jury could see that the government had withheld information regarding benefits that they had paid to this guy. When they talked
right.
to him when they talked to him on direct, they'd just given him a few payments. Then we found out he paid for his car. Then we found out he paid for his kids' mm-hmm. private school. Then we found out they paid for his water bill, that they paid for food. I mean, they were helping pay his mortgage. I mean, basically, they were supporting him. And it all started to come out what he was getting out of this case. And the jury was so disturbed at this all being withheld by the government and claims that they didn't know about it, that in the end, they didn't believe anything that this guy said.
Right.
And all seven of these people walked out. They had my guy looking at airplanes. He had a UV. He had a wireless antenna at his house. They had him on tape talking about how many kilos there were going to be, how much they were going to cost, where the landing strip was. They had all this stuff, but yet they walked my client out of the courtroom because they could not, because of one tape where the informant said the pilot's backing out. We need to kidnap the pilot. And my guy says, no, I don't want anything to do with that. This deal is done. Sounds like a withdrawal to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they found, because they didn't want to believe this guy.
Right.
So, you know, that's what you work on. You work on diminishing the value of the state's case. You try to show where they're not telling you everything you need to know, that they're coloring the testimony, that you're bringing out the real truth. And all of a sudden, some of that emotion leaves. And what emotion they have left is anger towards the state.
Right.
And I think he's done an admirable job going only where he needs to go.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Hezzy just got reminded he was snoring. So.
Yeah.
Okay, they woke him up. So, okay. So, be that as it may. So. Okay. All right. So, Hezzy, are you back with us now? He's talking to somebody else. Okay. So, you know, that I'm going to be interested to see how the remainder of all this testimony goes, to see just how well he's able to break down some of the expert witnesses. And I'm sure he's well prepared for it. And when he does, I think you're going to see that a lot of people are going to be looking at this case a little differently. But I want the press in particular to start covering both sides of this. I don't want them selling the prosecution case, which is what I see on CNN and I see on MSNBC. I even see on local red television stations. I think it's really time for them to start giving both sides of it. I mean, if he doesn't make any leeway, he doesn't show anything, then don't talk about it. But if he does something good on cross,
I did feel short, Mr. Bess.
Right.
My legs were so heavy.
He's not doing so good, obviously. He's not doing very well. I'm sorry to hear that.
That was it.
You can hear him. Okay, Hezzy.
I'm still a little bit on.
Hezzy.
Put
yourself on mute,
Hezzy.
Okay.
I think that was
I think you should be talking. Hezzy, you're talking about your medical issues on the radio. Okay, you got to put us on mute here. Okay.
I have it in. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, he's not hearing me, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I guess. Okay. So what else did we have on our agenda for our last 17 minutes?
Matt Gaetz.
Oh, perfect.
Oh, jeez, Matt Gaetz. Okay, you can start this one. You can start this one on your own.
All right, I'll start with the constitutional angle on it.
Okay, you do.
One of the things people ask oftentimes when you're looking at criminal charges at the federal level is so many federal criminal laws involve the crossing of state lines. When you look at Matt Gaetz, now, I don't know what charges, the prosecutors are potentially looking at, but the ones that seem most likely would be crossing state lines, either to engage in sexual activity with an underage person or crossing state lines with that person. And of course, your average person looking at that statute will say, "Why in the world does it matter whether you cross state lines, right? With a minor?" I joke with students when we talk about this stuff. You know, if there's a federal crime that makes it a crime to cross state lines with a kidnapping victim, if you throw me in the trunk of your car, tie me up and throw me in the trunk of your car, I'm not sitting there saying, well, as long as you don't cross into Georgia, this is fine, right? I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But what people want to understand is, of course, federal crimes are created by Congress, and Congress does not have what we call the police power, which is the power to regulate generally for the health, safety, and welfare of the population. Congress's powers are limited, and their broadest power is the power to regulate interstate commerce. And that's why you see so many of these federal crimes referencing the crossing of state lines. That's what we call a jurisdictional hook, right? Congress regulating something that typically it wouldn't be allowed to regulate because whatever activity they're aiming for involves the crossing of state lines. That gets it, that kind of shoehorns it into the Commerce Clause and into Congress's authority to regulate interstate commerce. So at the federal level, where Matt Gaetz is going to be in trouble is if he was crossing state lines or using the internet or any other kind of interstate infrastructure to commit crimes. That's how you get in trouble at the federal level.
Right.
So that's sort of the constitutional angle on this. What do you know about the factual allegations?
Well, the factual allegations are that, number one, at least one, and there are words, and there seems to be some evidence or some implication that there were other underage girls involved in sexual activity with Mr. Gaetz. But the one in particular deals with a 17-year-old girl who apparently he crossed state lines with, and that is a federal criminal offense. We also have situations involving interstate transportation for purposes of prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also a federal crime. I think he used to be called the Mann Act, if I'm not incorrect. And as a result of which, what we have is a situation where Mr. Gaetz also apparently has paid prostitutes to provide services. There was a picture of Mr. Gaetz with a bunch of high school girls. Apparently he was visiting a high school. And they all gathered around me, had a big picture. They were all smiling. And the caption on it was that picture has not aged well for Mr. Gaetz. Okay. And his problem is that he has very close ties to a former congressman from another one from the Panhandle who used to be I forget which county, but in a county, he was their tax collector.
They got
to be good friends, okay? And I think his name is Greenberg. I'm not sure. And the two of them were engaged. And this former congressman is saying that Gaetz is trying to draw attention away from himself by blaming him, meaning Mr. Greenberg. Mm-hmm. The problem here is that I just don't see that the Republicans are going to do anything about this. I just don't see them doing anything to punish Mr. Gaetz unless, for example, the 17-year-old girl is probably over 17 now, steps forward and says, yeah, that was me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it happened. Okay. Until there's such proof as that, I don't see Republicans doing anything in that case. Now, if he gets charged in federal court, and he may, he obviously will immediately lose all of his committee seats, and the chances are of him being reelected in 2022 are kind of negligible. But let's remember something. Donald Trump was elected president of the United States even though he was caught on videotape admitting to molesting women.
Mm-hmm.
So please tell me how this is going to have any kind of political effect on Matt Gaetz.
No.
Now, clearly, he senses that it will because 3 days before this all came to light, and he obviously knew he was under investigation, 3 days before that announcement came out, he was talking about leaving Congress early to go to work for Newsmax or News One or,
right. OAN.
Or Fox. Yeah, OAN. Mm-hmm. One America, okay, you know, that type of thing. This is what he was talking about doing, like, okay, I know something bad's going to happen, so I'm going to say I'm going to leave anyway. And his father must be very proud. You know, I say that sarcastically. Okay.
Yes.
We have a word for that in Yiddish, and this is your next Yiddish lesson. It's called a shanda, a person to be really ashamed of. Okay, he's a shanda. You know, but with all of that said, I don't know how much this is going to damage Matt Gaetz. I am not convinced that it's going to be fatal until the federal government, until the Justice Department does something and gets him convicted. Then they'll have to own up to it because the jury will have decided he was guilty. I just don't see anything else happening. So it's distressing. I'm sure that Liz Cheney is really disturbed and she'd love to be the prosecutor in the case. But they're not going to give her a chance to do that. But I'm sure she's prosecuting her case to Kevin McCarthy every single day.
Right.
And saying, this is who you hitched your wagon to. You want to go down with him or do you want to unhitch and let him run amok? And that's the decision they're going to have to make. I don't know what that decision will be, but that's the decision they're going to have to make.
Right.
But, Matt, you know, the effects, the criminal effects on him are numerous. And if Greenberg gets mad enough and starts testifying against him with some form of immunity, wow.
Mm-hmm. And he's already been indicted, isn't that right?
Yes, he has been indicted.
Right.
And now he's got something to bargain with, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And don't be surprised if he wasn't the original source.
Right.
To make himself more valuable.
Yeah.
And I kind of believe that that's probably true. Because they're fighting openly now.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I don't give Mr. Gaetz a lot of I just don't think that anything's going to happen to him until something really bad happens to him.
Right.
You know,
well, he's certainly being defiant,
Oh, of course he is. But I still suspect he's going to announce, even if he gets through this and survives 2021, I still think he's going to say he's not going to run in 2022.
Right.
Because by then Tucker Carlson will forgive him.
Yeah.
Because Tucker ain't happy with him right now.
No, because he kind of threw Tucker under the bus right during that interview, so mentioning some kind of indiscretion on Tucker Carlson's part.
Well, it kind of intimated it. He said, "You remember going to dinner with me?"
Right.
You
right.
remember my girlfriend? Okay. No, I don't. Thanks anyway. Cute blonde? No,
right.
I don't remember her. Okay.
Right.
And he basically Fox, who was Matt Gaetz on every single show, Matt Gaetz this, Matt Gaetz that, he was still on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Gaetz believes that his job is to be on television, not to be on the floor of the House of Representatives.
Right.
Okay. They stopped booking him, and you haven't seen much of him. And they stopped talking about his case because they are ready to throw him under the bus. As soon as he gets indicted, they're going to be all over him like white on rice.
Yeah.
So, at this point, I think, that obviously they have a witness who's going to say she was 17, and he knew it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're going to say. Not that
right.
him knowing it is an essential element, but it certainly would help prove the case, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so no, he's got more trouble than he knows what to do with right now. So,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, he doesn't work, so it doesn't matter.
He's another one of these people. You just have to wonder how he ever got elected. I mean, that's if we're screening, yeah.
Did you ever have something?
I just answered your question. You can come up with all the reasons why he wouldn't get elected.
Yeah.
His father's rich, okay,
yeah.
and he's young, and he thinks he's Jack Kennedy in a Republican coat.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And the theatrics are unbelievable. He shows up in Congress wearing a gas mask.
Yeah.
Right on the floor of the
or
House.
He goes to Wyoming to go after Liz Cheney.
All right. Right.
I'm sorry. I think that what we should do is have a big. What they should do is not me, but what they should do is that they should have a big rally with 1,000 women. In front of his local office, okay, in the panhandle, okay, and let's see how he likes that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know.
Yeah.
He'll probably say that they're all Antifa.
Right. Right.
Okay.
That's the standard Antifa line.
They're all left wing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
Right.
That'll be his answer.
Right.
Maybe we can get some high school girls to go there, too.
Or he'll say Merrick Garland orchestrated it, right? That's the...
Oh, yeah. Although it's...
That's the line, the investigation started under the...
but Bill Barr started the investigation. He was under investigation while Trump was still in office.
Right.
How do you blame that on Merrick Garland or on Democrats?
Yeah. My understanding, too, is that Bill Barr was aware... They knew it. Knew the investigation was underway and had no problem with it. Is that what you've heard as well?
That is correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He had no problem with it at all.
Okay.
I mean, it was like, oh, Devin Nunes is under investigation. Goody, goody gumdrops. Okay. You know, it's one of those things. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, he was more than happy to proceed.
Right.
Okay. And he wasn't going to step on it. He also knew that his time was coming to an end, and if he stepped on it, it would become public that he did that for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So he really
didn't
have a choice.
Right.
And I think at this point, I don't think that Merrick Garland has any choice but to indict him if he's got the evidence.
Right.
I think they're just not finished looking into everything. They don't want to jump the gun.
Right.
So he's about
especially
to
if they've got this other guy. You know, if they can get them to flip, you know, they're going to do that first. And
absolutely.
And Matt Gaetz's problem in that situation is that he's the bigger fish, right? And as I think the country's been learning, prosecutors usually flip up the line, not down. Right?
Interestingly enough, that's not necessarily true, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I learned a long time ago that the badder you are, the better the deal you get. The more people that you can inculpate, the better the deal you get.
Right.
So if you're the head of a drug conspiracy and you get caught and you start ratting out all the people that are your distributors or the people who are the importers or whatever it may be, they'll make a sweet deal with you.
Right.
Because they just, you know, you're getting off easy, but you're giving me a lot of other people. So look at this big crime ring that I've now busted.
Right.
So, you know, it in some cases it's up the ladder. In some cases it's down the ladder.
Right. Interesting.
You know, if you're
that makes
really,
sense.
Really bad, you know more. So we're going to make a deal with you.
Right. Right.
So it's kind of the deal. I mean... Sammy the Bull got John Gotti, but he also got a lot of people below John Gotti.
Right.
So, see what happens. Right. I mean, but, you know, the feds do like to make their deals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, okay, who's going to bid? I'm taking the highest bidder here.
Right.
And with Greenberg, I think that they don't really care too much about him. But Matt Gaetz is a big catch. Matt Gaetz is important.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. If you're doing bad stuff, don't be in the limelight. geez.
Yeah.
You know, stay under the radar.
The mindset that you can, yeah, the mindset that you can just get away with, you know, because you have for your whole life, right? That's the Donald Trump model, man.
That's correct. And then that's Matt Gaetz. He's gotten away with everything his entire life, including bar complaints and other things. I mean, he's just gotten away with everything.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
So sooner or later they get tired of it. So we're at 11:30. Hezzy, are you there? Hezzy? Hezzy's got another guest at 11:30.
Mm-hmm.
And I know his phone is on, but he may not be in his room.
I think I hear him in the background.
I hear him in the background. Hezzy, can you hear us? It's 11:30, Hezzy.
Okay.
You have another guest. Hezzy. Brendan
sounds
and
like
I have to
talking.
Go. We have a meeting.
Yeah.
We have a meeting.
Yeah.
We have a faculty meeting.
Yeah.
Hezzy.
The day job calls.
The day job calls, Hezzy. Can you hear us, Hezzy? No, this is a problem.
Yeah. And there's nobody else on the line with us.
I don't think he's here. He has to admit him into the room, and he hasn't admitted him into the room.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder. I'm on the line with him. I don't know if I can send him a text message. I don't think I can't send him a text message while I'm talking to him. So I don't know.
Right.
Let me see something here. Hold on a second. Let's see. I have another number for him, but I'd have to – let me see if I can find it. Let's see. Hold on. This is – now I have to figure this out. This is really silly, but I have to figure this out.
That's okay.
Okay. Oh, now I know how to get there. Okay. I got to go here. Okay. Okay. I'm going to send him a text message. Maybe he'll see the text message. Of course, it's more important that he take care of himself. There he is, right there. Here we go. Text message. All right, let me see if I can get through to him here.
All right.
All right, hold on. Izzy, we have to go, and you have another guest waiting. I think he's talking to his doctor.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Hezzy, we got to go, Hezzy. You're going to have dead air here. Hezzy? Yeah, he's talking to his doctor.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have any luck.
Don't think we're going to have any luck, and we have to go. So
yeah.
To his other guest who is waiting, I'm sorry. This is the second time this has happened, but he's presently speaking with his doctors, and so I don't know that he's hearing us. I'm sure as soon as he's done, he will realize and he will make contact with you. Okay? All right.
And everybody's listening.
Brent,
thanks for listening. We'll talk next week.
Thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. And hopefully Hezzy will be feeling better and be able to handle things a little bit better in the last half hour or at least by tomorrow. Okay? Everybody, thoughts and prayers for Hezzy and his health, okay? All right, everybody.
Yep.
Goodbye, Brendan. I'll see you in about a half an hour.
All right, Jeff. Yep, see you soon.
All right, take care, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I think I just need to learn a hell of a lot more. Okay. And then it would be nice if I could learn anything I could do to make a heart.
What?
Thank you.